why don't we just make a prison a hellhole? That way people won't want to go there. The problem is it doesn't work.
Alaska officials look to Norway for prison reform ideas. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska's university system president says the system can't withstand more budget cuts.
Now is the time to stop the cuts and to actually start investing back into higher education for the state.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by
Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com.
University of Alaska President Jim Johnson has spent the last few months advocating for more funding for the university, arguing that it cannot withstand continued budget cuts. The Alaska House of Representatives passed its version of the state operating budget on Monday by a narrow margin. It includes $19 million more for the university's operating budget than Governor Bill Walker had proposed. Today, at a forum in Juneau, Johnson said he was grateful the House decided to increase UA's budget and is hopeful the Senate will follow suit.
I can't control that process, certainly, but what I can do is continue every single day advocating for the interests of the university, but always setting those in the context of the interests of the state.
The university's annual budget has declined by more than $60 million since 2014, forcing cutbacks that have affected class offerings, staffing, and campus enrollment. In 2016, Johnson put forward Strategic Pathways, his plan to cut costs and consolidate administration while making the university function better. UA faculty and staff last year criticized Strategic Pathways and Johnson. The plan is in its final phase and is being implemented across UA campuses.
I think that the tough decisions the regents have made, the university has made, has gone a long way in persuading legislators that now is the time to stop the cuts and to actually start investing back into higher education for the state.
Part of that reinvestment effort includes the new Consolidated Alaska College of Education based in Juneau. Last week, the University of Alaska Southeast announced that Steve Atwater will lead the school as the new executive dean. The university has set a goal to produce 90% of the K-12 teachers hired in the state by 2025.
There's no more important job in Alaska, in my view, than teachers. And we're importing 70% each year, 70% of the new teachers hired in the state. And they churn at a very high rate.
Johnson said the university plans more scholarships and outreach to recruit prospective teachers for Alaska classrooms. The Teach for Alaska Presidential Scholarship provides up to $12,000 to Alaskans pursuing a teaching degree at any UA campus. A small group of Alaska corrections officers are spending more time getting to know inmates with the goal of helping them reintegrate into society once they're released. That's one of several reforms Alaska officials are drawing from the example of Norway in making changes to how prisons in the state operate. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on a recent talk state leaders gave about what they learned from a visit to Norway.
When Dean Williams was being confirmed as corrections commissioner, Senate President Pete Kelly remembers asking him this question.
Is there a place on planet Earth that has got prisons right? And he has said, I don't know, but if I find it, I'll let you know. And he did find it, and it was in Norway.
In the last two decades, Norway has made a series of changes to lower their recidivism rate, the rate people convicted of crimes reoffend. These changes include making life in prison look a lot more like normal life. Corrections officers act more like social workers, assigned to a limited number of inmates who they serve as coaches, motivators, and role models. The changes have contributed to a sharp decline in the recidivism rate. Instead of 66% of inmates reoffending, a rate similar to Alaska, now only 20% do. Kelly Williams and other state leaders saw what Norway is doing firsthand last year when they visited the country on a trip paid by California-based prisoner rights organization, the Prison Law Office. Williams says he wants to replicate what he saw.
I commonly get questioned, why don't we just make a prison a hellhole? That way people won't want to go there. The problem is it doesn't work.
The Department of Corrections has started a pilot program at Wildwood Correctional Complex in Kenai. A small group of officers act a little like social workers, with a goal of connecting inmates with programs that will help them reintegrate into society.
The way you sort of change these systems is one place at a time, and pilot and see how it works and see how the staff adapt to it.
Williams notes that Norway's approach is woven into how its corrections facilities are built. They're more like apartments surrounded by leafy, walkable grounds than traditional concrete block and steel bar prisons. But Williams says Alaska can make changes without constructing new buildings.
You can take what you have and adopt some of these principles and start to change the dynamics. You can use the buildings you have and start to repurpose them for the efforts and the purpose that you want.
Williams says the department can do a lot just by changing policies. For instance, some inmates spend time performing music and making murals, an approach that Norway has found to be effective. Another program benefits inmates at Highland Mountain Correctional Center in Eagle River who have shown good behavior and are nearing the end of their sentences. Volunteers take the prisoners outside of the prison to go to church and to have a meal. But Williams is also looking for support from the legislature. That includes a request for money for retraining officers, and he's asking for legislation that would allow inmates nearing the end of their sentences to use a computer. Senator Kelly, a Fairbanks Republican, is a leading conservative. He's enthusiastic about the potential benefits of the Norway model.
It was like so rare that you see a problem that in your experience is not fixable, and then you go somewhere else and you see it's fixed. And it's not only fixed, it's getting better.
Kelly notes that Ireland has also made changes inspired by Norway that haven't cost the country additional money and that have led to former inmates being productive after their release.
If they're punished, fine, but I want them to be able to get out, not just getting out of prison. That's not the end result. I want them back in our community. I want them to be integrated. I want them to be one of us. I want their time in prison to have counted.
Kelly says the effort will begin with the corrections officers, or COs.
These are good people. They want to do a good job. I believe we've given them the wrong job to do, and it is extremely difficult for them. The key to this thing is at the CO level. If you change the CO, we can change the system, and we will get a lower recidivism rate.
Williams says if the pilot programs are effective, he'll look to expand them. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Fairbanks teen is part of a group suing the federal government over greenhouse gas emissions.
I saw the lawsuit as kind of a last-ditch effort to give my generation a seat at the table.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds, narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart. Protect it. This message sponsored by Alaska Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
The state has issued an emergency order halting the killing of wolves along the northeastern boundary of Denali National Park. The order implemented in the Stampede Road area follows the trapping of Park Service collared wolves there this season. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, it's the latest action in a battle over wolves, also valued by wildlife viewers.
Speaking in Fairbanks last week, Governor Bill Walker said he's heard from many people concerned about Denali wolves. noting a 2017 Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly resolution in support of protecting the popularly viewed animals.
Some of it is tied to the tourism opportunity. So when I look at our resources, I have to look at it sort of on a balanced approach.
This was the right decision.
Anchorage biologist and wildlife advocate Rick Steiner petitioned the state for the emergency wolf harvest closure.
It's really kind of a recognition of the exceptional value of Denali Wildlife to the state's tourism industry, if nothing else.
A state news release announcing the emergency closure says preliminary data indicates up to 8 wolves may have been taken this season in the Stampede area, where the 5-year average is 4. This year's total won't be known until harvest reports come in later this spring. Denali National Park Science and Resources team leader Dave Schierkauer says the known dead collared animals belong to 2 park wolf groups.
We had one, the alpha male from the Riley Creek pack taken in the Stampede corridor, and 2 members of the Combe pack taken in a similar area.
Schierkauer says the park collars about 2 animals per pack, and he suspects additional non-collared park-based wolves have also been killed.
For every collared wolf that's harvested, there may be a couple or more uncollared wolves that are harvested.
Schierkauer agrees with state biologists that the Denali area wolf situation is not a biological emergency.
But we really like to preserve the opportunity for park visitors to view wolves, and these are the wolves that are more commonly seen along the park road.
Hunters brought you all the national parks, and they've kind of been usurped and bastardized by protectionists, and it's unfortunate.
Denali area trapper and hunting guide Coke Wallace laments closure of the state land near his home to wolf harvest as unnecessary, pointing to the species' dynamic nature.
The wolf population is, it's not static. You know, a wolf could show up here from the Brooks Range or from the Yukon Territory and take over and make his own pack.
Wolves are known to range far, and a collared Denali wolf was trapped this season near Delta Junction. The acreage along Denali's northeastern perimeter has been battled over for decades and was part of no-kill buffer zones created, adjusted, and finally in 2010 eliminated by the Alaska Board of Game. Because the Game Board has refused requests to reestablish a wolf protection zone, and a buffer bill has stalled in the Alaska Senate, Steiner is pushing the governor to take independent action.
Administratively establish a wildlife conservation buffer northeast of Denali for all predator species that people really want to see in the park in the summertime.
This brings temporary closure by Steiner and other wolf advocates more time to negotiate a permanent solution. The wolf hunting closure takes effect April 2nd, and the trapping closure begins April 9th. They run through the end of seasons, originally set to terminate on the 15th and 30th, respectively. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Should the courts be the place where climate change battles are fought? That's a question that's gained traction in recent years as individuals and municipalities have brought suits against fossil fuel companies and governments trying to prompt action on climate change. In March, a request from the Trump administration to dismiss one of the more high-profile cases was denied. Its plaintiffs are 21 young people who want to see the federal government take steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. One of them is a high school senior in Fairbanks. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig has this profile.
Last week, in a dining room filled with family photos and leafy green plants, Nathan Baring sat eating curry with his mom, Sharon, and his dad, Tom, and wrangled with them about weekend plans.
Maybe there's a possibility we might go shooting on Sunday.
I don't think so. It's
really?
Easter, bud.
Oh, it's Easter. Oh, well,
no,
nipped out of the bud.
Nathan is 18, and in some ways, his life tracks pretty closely with those of other kids his age. He likes to play soccer, ski on the weekends, and hang out at Carl's Jr., playing Clash Royale on his phone with his friends. But he's also suing the United States federal government.
I know that I started actual activism when I was 13, and I can trace my first letter to the editor into February in 2013.
Climate change isn't the only issue that Nathan cares about, but it's a core one.
Since the whole world has problems, I try to focus on what I can really take a bite out of. And I quickly realized that climate change is the pressing local problem in Alaska.
Nathan started with things like lobbying and letter writing, but he didn't feel like it did much. So when a nonprofit legal organization came looking for young Alaskans to join a suit trying to get the government to change its energy policies, he went for it.
I saw the lawsuit as kind of a last-ditch effort to give my generation a seat at the table.
The case is called Juliana versus United States, And basically the argument that Nathan's lawyers are making is that the government has known about climate change for decades and has made the problem worse by supporting an oil and gas-based energy system. Phil Gregory is one of the lawyers.
It created a danger that has and is causing and certainly will cause harm to these young plaintiffs, to the youth of America, and to future generations. So this is a constitutional violation of these young plaintiffs' rights.
Ultimately, Nathan and his co-plaintiffs are hoping for a decision from the court that would require the federal government to lower the emissions that contribute to climate change. Right now, the case is gearing up to go to trial. Nathan's lawyer expects by the end of the year. One thing that Nathan goes out of his way to acknowledge is how complicated this issue is for Alaskans. His mom is a public school nurse, and his dad is a public school teacher. Both their salaries are paid for by revenue from the oil industry. And many members of his community are even more directly tied to it, like his neighbors who work for the pipeline. He worries that the mainstream environmental movement isn't sufficiently addressing this issue. What would happen to these people's jobs if the oil industry went away?
I try to remind the people that I'm working with that we're dealing with people's livelihoods, and any solution has to bring the workers with it. You know, we can't just put caps on emissions and hope that the problem will go away. This is a multifaceted solution that we're looking for.
This fall, Nathan will be leaving Alaska to go to college. He eventually wants to become an international lawyer, and his big dream is to work as a liaison on climate action on the world stage. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks.
Unalaska is America's fish capital. More seafood is hauled into Dutch Harbor than anywhere in the country. But for residents, it's not easy to find fresh fish unless they catch it themselves. At the local grocery stores, even if seafood was caught in the Aleutians, it's exported before landing in local freezer cases. But as Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, it's getting a little bit easier to get locally caught seafood on the dinner table.
It doesn't happen often in Unalaska, but fishermen can sell their catch directly to customers. And if you're imagining a fish market, wipe away that image. Buying fresh seafood means going directly to a boat like Roger Rowland's. It's midday on a Wednesday in January, and people are streaming out to the dock to pick out tanner crab.
Can you have a help for me to carry it to my truck? Because I'm buying like $400 worth for like three families.
Oh, you want four dozen.
Ruby Warden and her daughter Pia are buying 48 crab. Some of it she'll serve to her parents when they visit from Hawaii. And the rest?
I think my other friend, she's taking it to California when she goes on vacation. And the other one is just here.
Local crab hasn't been sold on the dock in 2 years. This is Roland's second time selling crab this season. The first time, they took pre-orders. But today, anyone can buy. It's $12 a crab, or 12 for 100 bucks.
This year, they're very nice, very big. It's really encouraging to see the really nice product.
Another way it's getting easier to find local fish is at restaurants. At least all the dining establishments owned by Unicy, one of the big processing plants in town. Vic Fisher, no, not that Vic Fisher, looks forward to Taco Tuesday the way most people look forward to the weekend.
I'm sitting on Monday, I'm thinking about Taco Tuesday.
And he's excited to try tonight's menu. Alaska cod, just off the boat, marinated in chili lime sauce with cabbage slaw and chipotle creme fraiche.
I love fresh caught anything. As they were saying, it's fresh caught, and this is a new thing, absolutely a new thing. So I'm down for it.
The person responsible for all this fresh fish at the restaurant is Brett Richardson, the general manager of the Grand Aleutian Hotel. He's been around for 6 years and says previous managers serve fish from Asia.
I wondered why we weren't serving fish that we caught, if only not having to pay shipping costs. You know, something that's local and something that I think tastes pretty good. You know, should be on the menu.
His first move was to shift the hotel's weekly seafood buffet from a cornucopia of products from around the world to just Alaska fish. Cod, pollock, salmon, and scallops. In some ways, dealing with fresh fish makes his job more difficult. He's responsible for picking it up.
We don't have a delivery structure, so I literally just go and drive my little car down there and put it in the trunk, bring it on over.
He can get fish so fresh, it's been off the boat for less than an hour. Workers process the fish on a slime line, and instead of taking it to the freezers as they would for international customers, they walk it out to Richardson. Even with his three restaurants at the hotel and a few more nearby starting to serve local seafood, it's still not easy to find fresh fish on the island. So why is it so challenging? Richardson says it could be similar to why you can't get good coffee in Java, Indonesia.
The only thing they had there available for anybody was Nescafe. They export all of their coffee because other markets will pay, you know, much more premium prices for that.
Because of the seasonal nature of Alaska's fisheries, there won't be fish this fresh available year-round. The prime season, Richardson says, is at the beginning of the year, but he thinks they'll likely still have local cod through the end of April. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on 130 years of reliable lifeline cargo transportation to the Pacific and over 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
UA is working to build Alaska's future workforce with investment in UA-educated teachers. Individuals interested in a future in teaching can apply for the President's Teach for Alaska Scholarship for degree studies at any of the UA campuses. An education from the University of Alaska is an investment in the future. Application period closes May 1st. More at alaska.edu/learn-to-teach. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Dillingham residents of all ages turned out for SAFE's annual Choose Respect March last week. With signs, chants, and songs, they marched against sexual assault and domestic violence. KDLG's Izzy Ross reports.
We will not be violent!
The sun came out on Thursday as about 30 people gathered for the Choose Respect March hosted by SAFE in Dillingham.
You have been killed! Too many people!
Domestic violence and sexual assault are pervasive in Bristol Bay and across the state. According to an Alaska victimization survey, in 2015, half of all Alaskan women experienced intimate partner violence, sexual violence, or both. Greg Marks Miller is the education and outreach coordinator for SAFE, the shelter for victims of domestic and sexual abuse in Bristol Bay.
It's really what's holding us back in Dillingham. It's really what's causing the cycle of violence and the cycle of drugs and alcohol to continue. And it's just, it's the ugliest thing in our community. I don't care about the potholes. I don't care about like the snow melting. I mean, this is really, it's unfortunately part of us, and it's a really ugly part of us. I mean, we can be better. We can do better.
This march is just one of many that have taken place across Alaska. 9 years ago, former Governor Sean Parnell started Choose Respect marches as part of an initiative to raise awareness about sexual assault and domestic violence in the state. Susanna Henry was at the Dillingham March.
The first time I went to the Kinnickinnick Hospital, they said, do you feel safe in your home? And that was one of the standard questions that they ask you, even if you just have a sore throat. They want to know, are you safe in your home? And they're going to intervene if you say no. And I'd never been asked that question before by a health provider.
Take a chance! Let's hear your voice!
People came out not only to raise awareness of sexual assault and domestic violence, but also to provide an alternative. I caught up with Thomas Tilden at the end of the march.
We need to go back to what the elders said. We need to educate. Let's educate by demonstration or by choosing respect.
For Lucinda Zamir, showing people that there are options and support is why events like this one matter.
You know, I think domestic violence and intimate partner violence and so many other things are just quietly tolerated when people probably don't realize that they have a voice, they can speak up and they should speak up and they shouldn't just tolerate people treating them poorly, no matter what it is.
Choose respect!
Thursday's march showed that people in Dillingham will continue to raise their voices to confront domestic violence and sexual assault. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
Governor Bill Walker is inviting business people from around the state who are interested in boosting commerce with Alaska's largest international trading partner to come along on a China trade mission to be launched in May. A member of the Walker administration says the governor is especially interested in bringing along representatives of the mining and tourism industries. KYC's Tim Ellis reports.
For the past 7 years, China's been Alaska's biggest export market. Last year, the state sold more than $1.3 billion in goods and services to China. Most of that, about $865 million worth, was for seafood and other ocean products, followed by $356 million in mineral ore.
They are a key trading partner with Alaska, and I think that's why the governor sees great opportunities.
State Transportation Commissioner Mark Lucan says zinc from the Red Dog mine in northwestern Alaska accounts for a lot of those mineral exports, along with precious metals. He says the governor believes the state's mining industry could sell more of its products to China, and he says Walker hopes the industry will be well represented on the trade mission set for May 19th through the 26th.
There are several industries in the state that would benefit from better connections with customers in China, and so I think he's open to whoever would be interested in participating.
Lucan says the governor hopes that'll also include representatives of the tourism industry. The commissioner says he's working with Chinese authorities to establish direct flights from China to Alaska to accommodate the nation's growing interest in visiting Alaska year-round.
A lot of the Chinese tourists coming to Alaska are coming in the winter, coming to Fairbanks.
Chinese tourism for Fairbanks is really driven by the aurora. So we're seeing Chinese guests come from late summer all the way through to the spring.
Deb Hickok is president and CEO of Explore Fairbanks, the tourism promotion wing of the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. She says tourists from China and other Asian countries are increasingly coming to Alaska during the winter to view the aurora borealis.
The lion's share of our guests do come in the 5-month summer period, but we have seen growth in winter tourism.
Hickok says winter tourism has grown so much over the past 10 years that it now generates 45% of the revenue Fairbanks gets from tourism annually. She says she appreciates the governor's efforts to promote greater tourism with China and that she'd like to go along on the trade mission, but she's got a schedule conflict due to a major conference she'll be attending.
We absolutely are researching and solidifying plans to intensify our efforts in mainland China.
Information on how to sign up for the governor's China trade mission is available on the website of the Alaska Office of International Trade, which, along with the State Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, is organizing the trip. Information is also available on the Office of the Governor's website. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Adeline Baxter and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Dan Bross, Tim Ellis, and Ravena Koenig in Fairbanks, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Izzy Ross in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state. Seasonal spring routes now available to Kotzebue, Anchorage, Dillingham, and more. Information can be found at flyraven.com.
UA is working to build Alaska's future workforce with investment in UA-educated teachers. Individuals interested in a future in teaching can apply for the President's Teach for Alaska Scholarship for degree studies at any of the UA campuses. An education from the University of Alaska is an investment in the future. Application period closes May 1st. More at alaska.edu/learn-to-teach. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska. Opioids are powerful prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication protects children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.